Thanks so much for the introduction. This is my first time here, so it's really nice to be here. And I'm happy to tell you about what I've been excited about recently. So what I'll tell you about is based on work that I did a couple years ago, and now on based on an upcoming paper that will come to the archive in about a week or so. So the main theme of my talk today will be about both dark energy and dark radiation, and in particular, how they can go together. So as a rough outline, I'll first talk about dark radiation more generally, and then I talk about one model that I'm proposing, which is dark energy radiation. And I then will tell you about cosmological constraints on this model. And then I will talk about Earth-based probes that could potentially find signatures of this model. So let's start with dark radiation. So usually when we ask what is around today, what is stuff that we can go look for, we know that our universe is dominated by dark energy. We also have a big fraction in matter. We know that there's radiation around from the cosmic microwave background and various other radiation backgrounds, but that is a very small component today. And for it to even be visible to any meaningful degree on this pie chart, I had to enhance it by a couple orders of magnitude. So if we, as beyond, as particle physicists, want to ask, what about prospects of dark radiation? What could there be beyond the standard stuff that we know is there? Usually that dark radiation then lives in this sliver of uncertainty that we think is in the radiation that we already know is there. And that sliver is even smaller than the amount of radiation that's already quite small. But dark radiation itself is quite interesting. There are a lot of particles that are well-motivated that we try to look for as dark matter, but there are also interesting candidates to not necessarily be dark matter, to be there as extensions of the standard model. And I'm just mentioning a couple examples here, but there could be relativistic axions, dark photons, stale neutrinos, and even maybe your favorite model of extra radiation that can resolve cosmic tensions as well. So the direction that I want to go in today is I want to ask, what if we have a dark radiation component, but that dark radiation component doesn't live in this uncertainty sliver of the radiation? What if it lives in the uncertainty sliver of dark energy? And could that be much, much larger? Could there be a coupling between dark energy and dark radiation species that allows us to have large amounts of this dark radiation around today? And that type of radiation, I call it dark energy radiation. And I will go into more detail in what specific model I have in mind that could give you an order one fraction today that is only dark energy, dark radiation. Okay, so let's very briefly take a look at what the data is that we have. So if we take a look at the evolution of our universe, we have a very precise data set with the cosmic microwave background when the universe was only 100,000 years old. And it has very well-defined features that are very precise measurements. And the CMB does a phenomenal job in telling us how much matter there was and how much radiation there was. And in particular, how those two relate to one another. So in our standard cosmological model, we know how matter redshifts, how radiation redshifts, and those were the dominant quantities at the time the CMB formed. And dark energy at that time was extremely subdominant. So in lambda CDM, if we assume it's a cosmological constant, it is several orders of magnitude lower. So the CMB itself doesn't tell us anything about dark energy. It just tells us about radiation and matter. And usually the tight constraints on radiation come exactly from this measurement of radiation from the CMB. So because the CMB doesn't tell us anything about dark energy, there could be a subcomponent, if dark energy evolves dynamically, that is dark energy radiation. And I'm showing here this type of redshift behavior where it slowly increases in time, because that's what my model does, which I'll talk about in a couple slides. But my main point here is that the cosmic microwave background does not meaningfully constrain this type of setup. But we have other cosmological data. In particular, we have late universe data. And that is what tells us that we're now in a period of accelerated expansion. So in particular, we have the supernova data set, which very precisely measures the distance from us to the supernova. And what we can do with that data set, we can write down our hypothesis of what that distance looks like as a function of redshift. And usually, what we do is we assume lambda CDM. And within lambda CDM, our dark energy is a cosmological constant. The equation of state is exactly negative 1. And then if you have that hypothesis, you can fit to that data set, then you fit quite well. And what you find is that dark energy is about 70%, and dark matter is about 30%, exactly what we showed on the pie chart before. But now if we relax our assumptions a little bit, really is true is that dark energy in principle doesn't have to be a cosmological constant. It could evolve in redshift, and its equation of state can also evolve in redshift, as long as your model is able to fit this Pantheon data set still. So going in this direction, now I want to look at dynamical dark energy. So the idea of having dynamical dark energy is quite old. A lot of you have probably heard of quintessence. But the idea is very similar to what happens in inflation. What if we have a scalar field that is slowly rolling on a potential, and that type of energy density exactly has these properties that we get negative pressure, and we get an equation of state that is roughly negative 1 with small corrections. So it is able to fit the phenomenology well. And here in this very simple setup with just the quintessence field, we need it to be slowly rolling to have negative pressure. And here what's damping the field, what makes it roll slowly, is just Hubble friction, which is just that the universe itself is expanding. So this is what it's keeping us on the slow roll. And you may ask, okay, why do you want to consider that? I was happy with the cosmological constant. roughly my motivations are a cosmological constant is a very simple explanation, but it is a very fine-tuned. And potentially, if you consider dynamics, that may be a way forward to try to alleviate some of this tuning. That being said, my model that I'm talking about today, it does not address the tuning. And from another perspective, more a data-driven point of view, is if we, to compare to data, it's useful to have another hypothesis. So we have lambda CDM. And very often, people also compare data to a very simple Taylor expansion in the equation of state of the dark energy. But if we have a model that's maybe closer connected to particle physics, we can have a testable hypothesis that we can compare to the data. What I'm working on is an addition to this idea, and this is, what if the scalar field that is slowly rolling and making up dark energy, what if that couples to other light particles? And generically, what can happen if you have a coupling between the scalar field and other light particles is that you can produce these particles. So you can have the phenomenology where you have particle production that manifests itself as an additional friction coefficient in the equation of motion of the scalar field that extracts energy from the slowly rolling field and sources a radiation bath. So now in this setup, you have two components, no longer one. You have the scalar field, and then you have the radiation that it sources. And this is just a continuity equation. And if this was 0 here, this radiation would just redshift like you're used to as I to the negative 4th. But because we have the source term here, we can have very different redshifting behavior. One intuitive way of thinking about this is you can have roughly a steady state where if we neglect this term, the rate of dilution of your radiation is exactly compensated by the rate at which you're sourcing it. And then you're able to maintain roughly a steady state temperature or even a temperature that is increasing. And as a particle physicist, so this is phenomenologically interesting, but particularly what I find interesting about it is that you have a dark energy model that is producing something physically that is around, that is giving you something that is more than a gravitational probe of dark energy. Most things that we look at gravitationally and constrain the equation of state, but in this type of setup, you would have a abundance of dark radiation that is there today in our universe and could potentially be a window into learning more about dark energy. So you may ask, okay, this how could we have this type of behavior? And it turns out if we start with a Lagrangian and we want to ask what type of a Lagrangian can give us this phenomenology, it turns out a very simple setup. Let's say we have an axion or an axion-like particle, and we just couple it to a non-abelian gauge theory. If we have this type of coupling, this phenomenology can emerge. And in the next slide, I'll talk in more detail how exactly that happens. But for now, if we want to ask if this Lagrangian is what is producing the radiation, what populates our radiation? And if we try to figure out what's in it, we need to know what particles could constitute it. So very natural ingredients are basically at zeroth order what is populating the radiation are just the gauge bosons of the non-abelian gauge theory. So we had a temperature where the theory is not confining and the gauge bosons are free and relativistic, and that is the main component of this radiation. Then it's also very easy for the axion itself to become thermalized because it's also coupling to the gauge bosons. And you could potentially have fermions that you charge under your gauge group, and then they could also easily become thermalized in your bath. So these are natural candidates to live in this radiation. Are there any questions so far?
Yeah. You've mentioned temperature a few times. So is it crucial in your scenario that this is a non-trivial sector? Like it's not just a single free gauge, but like you've also mentioned non-abelian. So if I just had an abelian theory and I made a bunch of photons that don't interact after they're produced, would they be produced at some finite temperature? Because it's not really thermal here.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you could also consider a phi FF dual coupling. The phenomenology of that would look different from this one. And there are a couple reasons for it. One is, as you mentioned, photons don't generically thermalize. But there is a mechanism where it's called a tachyonic instability, where you exponentially produce these photons, but they're very IR dominated. So you produce a lot of very soft modes. So that you wouldn't be able to capture in kind of this thermalized phenomenology. And this is what I'll talk about in the next slide, the source of the friction, the reason why this is quite efficient, is unique to the non-abelian nature of the group. It depends on sphaleron processes that you don't have in a U1. So your particle production does happen, but it's quite different. Does that answer?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the friction, I don't see why it is relevant here, because by the coupling that you have, I mean, I assume the phi field is, I mean, very light, I mean, orders of magnitude, I mean, around the Hubble rate, right? And the coupling is suppressed by F, the axion decay constant. So parametrically, the decay rate is like m cubed divided by F squared, which is very, very small, right?
Actually, I'll go into what the rate is, but it doesn't scale with the mass of the particle. It scales with the temperature of your bath. And that is exactly, maybe you're thinking of the reason why this friction arises, it's not perturbative. It's from non-perturbative processes. It's from the sphalerons in your theory that give you efficient particle production. And that's where the scaling comes from.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've previewed a little bit. This seems a little bit like magic. How do we go from this Lagrangian to these equations of motions? So let's dive into it. So at first order, what happens is we write down this interaction, and then we use our Euler-Lagrange equation. And what we see is that there should be a term that shows up on the right-hand side that is just linear in this GG dual term. So this is what we would naively expect. And this is indeed the term that you get. But when you're at a finite temperature, this term has an expectation value. This is your thermal expectation value of your theory in the presence of this coupling. And this is a difficult operator to calculate directly. But we can we can use linear response theory in the regime where the phi field is moving slowly and the plasma interactions are very fast. We can use linear response theory to calculate what this quantity is. And we can expand it in as a function of phi and phi dot. And that's exactly what we do. And it turns out the first order term, generically, should be something like a mass correction to your potential. That's just the thermal mass. If we normalize stuff in vacuum, but if we're at finite temperature, we need to normalize again. And for a very simple theory, let's say this operator was just fermions, this mass correction would scale just as your temperature. So this would be quite large. And then the second term that we get here is exactly this dissipative term that is linear with phi dot. It turns out if this, in our theory where this is an axion, this thermal back reaction is suppressed because it's not allowed by symmetry. The axion is a pseudo-Goldstone boson, and therefore it's protected from getting these corrections. So in a way, this is one of the perfect Lagrangians that give you that phenomenology where the leading order term that you get is your thermal production of particles. And so for this story to make sense, your temperature needs to be larger than Hubble. You only have a well-defined thermalization if that's the case. And that temperature needs to be such that your alpha here is not strong. Because once it becomes strong, your GG dual, your gauge bosons confine. And then we can ask, so how do we know what exactly this quantity is? And this quantity is something that we can relate to the sphaleron rate in SUN, because the particle production in this theory is related to sphaleron processes of your theory. Yes?
Sorry, a very naive question. So, like, photons get thermal masses in plasmas.
Yes.
And they are protected by gauge symmetry. So this mass doesn't break gauge symmetry, but it does give a mass to the photon. So why?
Yeah, so the gauge fields can get a thermal. The worrisome part is about the phi field getting the mass, not the gauge bosons.
Yeah, he's asking why global symmetries that would protect this. Well, I mean, this is a shift symmetry. Why shift symmetries are enough to protect thermal masses while gauge symmetries are not? And that's why he's asking. It's not trivial, right?
Let me see. I think I have to think about that more. But for one small side comment is that the shift symmetry from the axion is also not exact. We're breaking it by writing down the potential. But that's a soft breaking. So any mass corrections that we would get for the axion are protected by the soft symmetry breaking. And for the gauge symmetry, I have to think about that. But a side question, is everybody here familiar with sphalerons? Or should I say a couple words about them? So sphalerons are related to the vacuum structure of your theory. So in your one theory, if you write down the field equations, classically of your theory, you have one vacuum. But this is not true if you have a non-abelian theory. In a non-abelian theory, you have a plethora of vacua that have a periodicity condition. And depending on, basically, they have called a winding number that's associated with it. And these winding numbers can be quantified by something that's called the Chern-Simons number. So you have a vacuum at zero, but then you also have periodic vacua. But the important part is that you cannot go from one to the other perturbatively. You have these big potential barriers between them. So physically, what that means is if you start out in one configuration and you want to go to another vacuum, you could try to tunnel to that other vacuum, and that's what instanton processes do. Or you could try to go over this barrier. And physically at this barrier, we have a field configuration that has some energy in it. So you can put in some energy into your system, make your weird configuration, and then relax back into your other minimum. But otherwise it's difficult to go from one vacuum to the other. And it's a non-perturbative effect, and it only exists in theories beyond a U1 because of the structure of the theory. And these Sfalerone processes are what is integral for having efficient particle production in this theory. So another way of thinking about this process is that you can integrate this by parts, and then you get a term that is proportional to phi dot. And our phi dot has an expectation value. And what that basically does is giving a linear potential to these Sfalerones, and you're driving vacuum transitions. And so you're driving, kind of making these finite energy configurations that then decay into your particles. And those particles are your gauge bosons. And this is unique to this type of theory. So the Sfalerone rate is a quantity that has been very well calculated in the literature because it's relevant for baryogenesis. And we can relate that friction coefficient to the Sfalerone rate. The Sfalerone rate tells you if you have a finite Chern-Simons number at how temperature fluctuations diffuse that number. And it scales as alpha to the fifth over F squared. And this is roughly that you can see that this is a non-perturbative quantity. It doesn't scale as naively as the alpha squared that we would have expected. But we can use that result from the Sfalerone rate to also quantify what the particle production rate is in this theory. Okay, so this is the setup that I'm thinking about. Oh, yes.
Just so that I get some intuitive understanding. So how does the occupation number evolve, like in this theory, for the particles that you created, or is it of relevance?
It's a thermal distribution.
Right.
So and the I'll show a plot in a little bit, but you basically have a temperature that's slowly increasing, and at any point in time the distribution is given by the temperature. It's just a Boltzmann distribution. That was your question.
Yeah,
right?
I guess like in part I was thinking sometimes for such theories that I read about, it's like it's an exponential growth in the occupation number.
This is what happens when you have a tachyonic instability, I think, which can happen in U1 theories. It can also happen in an SUN theory, but that is not the regime in which you thermalize. As soon as you thermalize, to have this exponential enhancement, you need an instability. But as soon as you thermalize, your thermal masses stabilize all these instabilities, and those processes are no longer efficient. You start being in this regime where.
So are you assuming like the system is thermalized throughout the universe evolution, or there's some point you are going to talk about the initial?
So I'm mostly thinking about this as phenomenology in the late universe. So the typical Fs that I'm considering are of order GeV. So there is a cutoff to the theory of where the effective field theory breaks down.
Yeah, so like what temperature in the our universe would it correspond to when like you need to hit this transition?
So this temperature is always a sub milli electron volts. It never
of our universe temperature. What would it correspond to? So like when our universe is at around like MeV, like when you need to like talk about this phase initial condition, or like when our universe is like GeV, you need to talk about this initial condition.
Much later. Like when do you produce these particles?
In the very beginning.
Yeah. So the initial condition. Question is what you're asking, if you start at zero temperature, do you thermalize? Is that?
Yes. Would there be a reason to have it done early enough that we won't know? Or can you start at least?
So in in this work, I didn't think too much about the initial conditions, but I think the rough story is that also in a non-abelian theory, you can have particle production, non-thermal particle production, through effects like exponential tachyonic instabilities. So then you would have an abundance of very infrared modes, and then the question is, do they thermalize?
Yeah.
And that's quite a subtle question, but I'm actually in another context. This is also relevant in warm inflation scenarios, for example. In another context, I'm working with a group of people on putting this on a lattice, on a cosmolattice, and doing a classical simulation where we track that process and then see how robustly you thermalize. But yeah, for this is.
So Amin and some people were doing some early universe models and a particle production that they want to simulate on lattice. So anyway, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Maybe you tell me more about it in a little bit. Okay. So this is the model and the setup I'm thinking about. So let's talk about cosmological constraints on the viability of this. So what I did I teamed up with a team of data experts in cosmology, and I implemented this model in class. Class is a cosmological Boltzmann code that solves all of your cosmology, not only at the background level, but also at linear order and perturbation theory. And the potential that I put in for the scalar field is just a linear potential. And then I put in three different models. One is minimal dark energy radiation, which has the Lagrangian that I described to you, where we have a friction that depends on the temperature of the bath. Then I also put in a toy model where my friction is just constant. And then I put in basically a quintessence version of this where I don't have any thermal friction and it's just Hubble. And in that model, the dynamical component is not dark radiation, but instead the kinetic energy of your field. And then I compared it to current data, in particular Planck, BAO, and Pantheon. And we also used forecasts of Simons Observatory CMB data and projections of the of Roman, previously called WFIRST. And that's they have more supernova that go out to higher redshift. So Roman especially is predicted to do a better job in constraining the equation of state of dark energy at late times.
Sorry, can I ask you something? Is this model tuned? So in quintessence models, it's extremely hard to build quintessence models because you need the potential to be flat, etc. Here, do you need the potential to be like super flat? And is this interaction going to mess up that flatness?
So the interaction is not messing up the flatness because you are protected by the shift symmetry. That's
but there are instanton corrections.
No, not at temperature. So instanton corrections become exponentially suppressed at higher temperatures. So those mass corrections are also very small.
And then I will say that there are spotter corrections, as Marius was pointing out. If there are instanton corrections, I don't see why there aren't any spotter corrections to the potential.
What do you mean by spotter corrections to your potential?
I mean there are. At the perturbative level, yes, so there shouldn't be any corrections to the potential, but I'm not entirely sure that at non-perturbative level, even at high temperatures, there are no corrections.
Well, but that is the thing. This is a quantity that has been very well studied as a function of temperature. So these Phaleron corrections that you're mentioning, they should kick in at higher temperatures, but especially because it's important for the QCD axion,
right.
This has been very precisely calculated. What is the back reaction as a function of temperature? And what you find is that it's largest at zero temperature, and then the relevant quantity is the temperature over the confinement scale of your theory, and as the temperature goes above it, those corrections become very suppressed. That is something that is well known in the literature, and particularly has been studied for the axion.
So you need temperatures that are, so what's the confinement scale of your sector?
So I'm considering alphas that are 0.1 or lower, but in principle at some temperature much lower than millielectron volts, this could the alpha could run towards confinement, but this can happen. There's a degeneracy in a way between my scale F and my alpha. So I could choose very small alpha such that you do not confine until extremely low temperatures that you don't reach.
I mean, like, then it's the classic, like, e to the minus 4 pi over r.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what?
Like, these corrections you are talking about is suppressed by e to the minus 4 pi over alpha.
Yeah, so, but I don't know which.
So, like, it's like a, yeah, she's saying, like, it's 0.1, so it's like e to the minus 100.
Yeah. Okay.
Was there another question? No? Okay. Okay, then, okay, let me tell you about the results. So I put in all of these models, and for comparison, I also put in the standard W0WA. And here are results. So what we're finding is that at the 2 sigma level, the amount of dark radiation in our universe, and this is robust between the toy model and the full model, is about 3%. So 3% of the total energy density in our universe under this model could just be dark radiation. And one thing that I wanted to point out is also that regardless of the model that you put in, that 3% is quite robust. So very naively, when I looked just at the equation of state and how it evolves in these different models, there are some differences. And some hope would be that data could actually resolve them. But what this is telling you very quite robustly is that once you marginalize over the other parameters we have in cosmology and those uncertainties, is that really the data is not able to discriminate between those models. So if you do have a dynamical component, it will show up, but it will not be able to resolve whether you have dark energy radiation or a kinetic component in your quintessence field. And on that point, I also want to point out, so the W0WA model has 2 free parameters in a way rather than 1. So of course, the uncertainty is bigger. But it also, in a way, is a little bit of a funny parameterization that doesn't map on very well at all to a simple scalar field model with 1 degree of freedom. So just looking at W0WA, it looks like the equation of state is very under-constrained, which is actually because these 2 parameters kind of give a large uncertainty to each other. There's a large degeneracy in a way. So if you just put in a simple model, you find that you don't. It's really quite constraining the data we already have. And with future data, we could expect this to tighten by a factor of 3. So if our universe is lambda CDM, which of course we don't know right now, but if it is, then the constraints on the dark energy radiation would tighten to 1%.
Saga, maybe I missed it, but did you fix in the simulation gamma here, or is varied in the chains as a free parameter?
We varied it. Yeah, we varied the potential and the friction coefficient. So then if you now take a look at how the energy densities evolve, and these are all points from the chains. So these are the actually 2 sigma roughly cosmologies that we're finding, is at late times, matter is becoming subdominant to dark energy. Our dark energy is made up out of a sum of basically the scalar field, which is very slowly becoming more dynamical. It's barely resolvable on this plot. And we do have in the dynamical component that's growing in every one of these models. And the regular radiation component is very much subdominant. So it's somewhere down here. And we can be all the way up here.
So what's special about that time? Like when it...
About which time?
Well, so your orange curve, you know, grows very steeply and then it sort of plateaus. That's
oh, this yes. So this goes back to the question. We varied both the slope and the friction, and it turns out in the minimal model, which is this one, at the background level, and these constraints for the most part are dominated just by the background behavior, there's a degeneracy between the slope and the friction. So you could have an extremely steep potential and a very large friction, and it looks the same as if you have it be flatter. It turns out in the minimal model, that degeneracy is broken by the perturbations. If you have a very steep potential and very large friction, the friction gives you large fluctuations in dark energy. So that rules out very, very steep potentials and very, very large frictions. So it turns out that the ratio of the thermal friction to Hubble cannot be huge. It needs to be like somewhat comparable. It can be an order of magnitude or so larger, but it can't be several orders of magnitude larger. And what happens here is that the friction, because Hubble is growing as you go back, you come dominated by Hubble instead of the thermal friction. And that's why you see a change kind of in the behavior here, this kink. And in the toy model, we do not, this degeneracy is not broken. So we chose a larger friction such that that transition happens later. Okay, so.
So before you move on to that, like I guess like you mentioned a little bit about anisotropy. So like my understanding from like this work is like when you transfer like energy between the two fluids, like you generate new anisotropies, which grows power law exponentially like at later time, right?
Yes.
So was it like accounted for like in your analysis?
Yes, this is accounted. This is exactly what then picks out. Basically, it pushes you to shallower potentials where this effect is not large. But exactly that effect that you mentioned, and this only happens in the full model. In the toy model, when you don't have temperature dependence, the perturbations don't grow. But in the full model, when you have temperature dependence, the fluctuations in the radiation and of the dark energy of the scale field couple. And the fluctuations grow in both of them, very large. And that gives you a universe that's not smooth, and we know that our universe is pretty smooth. So that's ruled out.
So the sound speed in this five-field isn't large enough just to suppress these perturbations.
In the usual intuition from quintessence is that you just have a source term that's gravity and that's very small, and you don't see it. But if you have a friction that is very large, much, much larger than Hubble, much, much larger than all the other scales in your problem, then you start seeing a big enhancement. And the way that shows up, let me see. I can show my backup plot on this. No. That's not what I wanted. Okay, sorry.
we don't need to necessarily need to see it like a slideshow, right?
Okay.
Just look at the
slide. I have it here. Sorry. Junwoo, I think this is the point that you were asking about. So if these are the equations basically for the perturbations.
Yeah.
And if we have here a friction coefficient that is very large, then these fluctuations grow. And the way that we see that in cosmology is basically here in the low L multiples of the CMB. And this may seem counterintuitive, or at least for me initially it seemed counterintuitive because I was thinking, well, CMB happens early, this stuff happens late. But what happens is that the photons here in the CMB that we measure, they travel through gravitational potentials. And the data is sensitive to how those are changing in time. And if your dark energy, which is dominated at late times, if it's not smooth, then you get a large effect there, which is basically like a huge enhancement of a late.
But I remember like those perturbations has some characteristic k, right?
Yes, there's, yes.
So what was that? I remember it's mostly like a, at least like what I remember from like those papers Merdad wrote, like it's substantial.
It depends on what determines at which k this becomes important depends on your ratio of the friction to Hubble. Like it's basically the ratio of this guy over h. And that determines at what point modes grow. And there you can enter a regime where then you get a large enhancement here. But that is not the regime that our universe is in, because we know that dark energy has to be pretty smooth. But this is what is biasing. This is what's breaking the degeneracy and biasing the models to shallower potentials. So going back to a question that Daniel was asking, in the toy model, in principle, you could have a very steep potential, very large friction, and then maybe you don't need to have something like a transplanking field excursion. You can just have a very narrow range that you transverse, and this works out. But what the full model tells you is that compared to regular quintessence, you can order only do a factor of 10 or so better because you're not viable. Because the perturbations otherwise make this model be not viable. Okay. So now what I want to ask, I want to slightly shift gears and ask, let's say we have around these 3%, so we have stuff. And so far we kind of said it was in dark sector, dark axion, dark SUN. But now what if that stuff couples to us? What if there are BSM couplings? Can we potentially go and look for these? So as a summary, we have a temperature. The radiation needs to have that temperature or be smaller. And the distribution is just thermal that we see today. And then just starting with the axion, there was work in the literature that kind of took a closer look at what our sensitivities are to relativistic axions by a group in Berkeley. And specifically, let's say we consider a coupling of the axion to electromagnetism, there are a couple qualitative factors that we have to consider if we ask, how does a dark matter experiment that looks for this axion, how is it sensitive to a relativistic axion? And they're all intuitive. One is, what is the ratio of the energy densities? We know we have this much dark matter. We know we could have this much dark radiation. What's that ratio like? In my model, this is a factor of 10 to the 6 suppression. Even though we have 3%, potentially, we still have much less than dark matter locally. The other one is basically, what is the coupling that you constrain, the maximum one? And there are already limits on also relativistic axions from astrophysics. So we know that below that limit, there can't be any of them. So we could ask, what is our reach in those couplings? And the last factor has to do with basically the quality factor of our experiment. So an axion experiment, you could think of if we have a cavity that tries to put your signal on resonance, how much can you ring up that cavity? And that depends on the dispersion of your signal. So for dark matter, that's a factor of 10 to the 6, and it's just your energy spread. For a thermal signal, that is 1. So your quality factor is much, much lower. And what they found in their analysis is that roughly, you scale as a square root of that factor of 10 to the 6. So if we take this naive scaling and we ask, what about with the future generation of axion experiments that we have upcoming, and we use that scaling, do we have reach to this signal? So usually, we're used to seeing mass here. But for me, this is now this is energy. This is basically the kinetic energy of my signal. And there is a target just for a relic axion background that people may try to look for. And here, this is quite generous. If we take the uncertainty in dark radiation to be quite large, this is where you would expect your signal to be. And my signal is several orders of magnitude larger. But what we can see from this is that it still seems quite hopeless to try to reach this with existing dark matter experiments. So this is very challenging. However, there are efforts ongoing that are trying to build an experiment that's actually targeting this, the relic target. And for any type of experiments like that, this signal would be a benchmark that you reach way before that. Then let's talk about another scenario. What about neutrinos? So one interesting feature of this model is that you can actually thermalize one of the standard model neutrinos in that dark radiation. So in order for this to happen, it needs to be lighter than milli electron volt or so. Like, all the particles need to be lighter, otherwise they can't be thermalized. But if you, let's say you have a fermion in your sector, and it's in the adjoint representation, you couple it to a sterile fermion, you can thermalize a right-handed guy. And then if you have a Dirac mixing term, you can pretty easily thermalize a left-handed standard model neutrino if it's light enough. And that could be cool because the number density of standard model neutrinos is given by the temperature. And the relic background that we expect tells us we have about 100 per cubic centimeter. But if we have a larger temperature, if we basically take this one neutrino species and we heat it up, we can get an enhancement in that number density by two orders of magnitude. And that could be cool, potentially. So let's look at prospects of detecting that. So one experiment that is going after the relic neutrino background is the Ptolemy experiment. And their setup is the following. They're trying to use neutrino capture on tritium that is mounted on graphene. So we have tritium has a beta decay process, which basically gives a huge background to the signal you would expect from neutrino capture. And what is measured is this electron that comes out of here. So you, beta decay happens, you have an electron, and you can measure that spectrum very exactly. And here, this is a plot shown from Ptolemy that shows you just the size of the background spectrum. But if you have a neutrino coming in, what happens is that you, if it's a scattering instead of a decay, you contribute energy to the process. What that allows you to do is it allows you to have an electron with a little bit more energy. So it can be beyond the endpoint of that background. And what Ptolemy is ideally designed for is for a non-relativistic neutrino to come in. And that contributes that extra energy. And it's most sensitive to the more massive ones. And with an ambitious type of experiment, Ptolemy would see about four events per 100 gram per year detector. And that's very low statistics. So in my signal, I would be sensitive to the temperature, to the kinetic energy of the standard model neutrino instead of the mass. And it would be much broader of a peak. And potentially, there are many more events. But this is a huge but, to resolve a signal with kinetic energy of order milli-electron volts or so, you need an amazing resolution. So one of the big breakthroughs that Ptolemy is making is that they were able to build a detector that can basically measure the outgoing electron with an incredible resolution. I'll get to the but in a second. But what I want to show you first is what I did is I reproduced these plots that Ptolemy had. And here, if we look at the standard neutrino background, this is the gray signal. And then I overlaid my signal, both in the normal neutrino mass hierarchy and in the inverted one. And what we see is, especially in the normal mass hierarchy, we get quite a larger signal. So there are more events we could potentially detect. But, and this is going to the point of the resolution, here I'm assuming 6 milli-electron volts. And it's already hard to detect beyond that beta decay background spectrum. And this is a very challenging target, particularly, and how sensitive we are kind of scales with that resolution that we could achieve. But one big but in this entire story is that in recent years, it was pointed out that if you mount tritium on graphene, you basically put your nucleus in a potential. And what happens is that you spread out the wave function of your nucleus. This is just quantum mechanics. But the problem is that the uncertainty of that already puts you at around 50 milli-electron volts or so. So that uncertainty is huge. And it's quite a fundamental thing. So it's much larger than the resolution that the detector was hoping to achieve. They were aiming for 10 milli-electron volts. So this is an issue. Possible solutions. So I talked with Chris Tully about this quite a bit. They're trying to look at potential options in the future. One of them may be spin-polarized liquid tritium, which has a fundamental uncertainty about 5 milli-electron volts. I know that they're also investigating different nuclei. I think one of them is tullium, which is funny because Chris Tully is the PI of the experiment. So if it was, yeah. But this is a subject to R&D and maybe also not too optimistic that this will be possible to resolve this type of signal. So let's look at one optimistic scenario where we can maybe detect something. Let's look at dark photons. So dark photons are also quite generically populated in this dark radiation. One example is, what if your fermions that are in there, what if they're charged under a dark U1? And if we have a dark U1, it's quite generic to mix with the standard model U1. So what if we had such a mixing and what are our sensitivities to it? Before I want to ask about the direct detection prospects, let's first look at the viability of dark photons in the first place. And these are all bounds that are independent of the dark photon being dark matter. They're just on the existing of such a kinetic mixing. So the gray bounds are things like light through wall or CMB oscillating away into a dark photon. But if I'm postulating that there is a bath of dark photons already around, I also have the reverse process. So what I can have is I can have my dark photon, which is hotter, I can have it oscillate into a CMB photon. And here, using the constraints from Kobe and Firas, so usually the CMB constraints are on a CMB photon oscillating away and there being less than you would expect. But in my case, I can have a dark photon oscillating into a visible photon and kind of being in an overabundance of what we have detected to not be there. And that gives you a constraint both for this oscillation happening non-resonantly and resonantly. But, and this is what I want to point out, is if we look at relativistic dark photons, all of this parameter space here is viable because we're not fixing the mass of this dark photon. It can be down here, it can be up here. All it needs to be is lighter than milli electron volts to be thermalized. So there can be a wide array of viable couplings that can be actually quite large for this dark photon to have to interact with us. So now if we go through similar arguments as with the axion about energy densities, quality factors, and couplings, what we find is I'm showing here a benchmark. So I'm taking the benchmark of kappa being around here. If we take this benchmark, we map our future experiments onto it. The current data that we have puts us here, but the next generation experiments, such as dark matter radio, for example, or alpha and max, and potentially red, do have some sensitivity to that signal. And this is something I'm quite excited about in the moment, and I've started talking with various experimentalists on these collaborations, what exactly it would take to, in both the data taking, but also in the data analysis, to not miss such a signal if it was there. Because the usual scan strategy is that you basically, you look at a very narrow band and you look for a signal, and here this, for example, for DM radio, where you, this would be something that shows up in a lot of different bins where you're measuring, and you would have a signal that's increasing in frequency. So you may think that this is a background and rejected. So
ask about Max and Brent, like what are you assuming for the antenna pattern to make this plot?
For the what?
Antenna pattern of the detector.
Oh, okay, very good question. I was just talking with Andrew Sonnenschein about this and with...
Yeah.
So the one tricky thing about Brett is that they're have this very very smart design where they the photons of a particular frequency bounce around a lot in their detector, and then they're being focused onto one pixel that is resolving the measurement. And one big concern that you could have here is that if you have a relativistic signal with a wide spread, is that you only get a tiny, tiny fraction of your signal into that pixel, and therefore lose a lot of sensitivity. So that in this curve, I have not accounted for, but talking with Andrew about this, what he mentioned is that they are considering potentially doing something like putting additional refractive gas in their detector, such that you don't have one path that is mapping you onto your pixel, but that you get many scatterings, such that you would be able to focus also, or in that case not focus, but redirect wider frequencies potentially onto that pixel. So these are subject to research and development. I made that plot before I had the detailed discussion with Andrew. So Brett is a big question mark. But with dark matter radio, this is much more straightforward.
Yeah.
So there should
be. Yeah, that's true.
You're saying MadMax has similar constraints as Brad?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to know.
So I have a really basic question. So the temperature here, dark radiation is like milli electron volt, right?
Yeah.
But that, so the energy of dark radiation bath is coming from the cosmological constant. But how does energy conservation work? The cosmological constant doesn't have a milli electron volt to the fourth power in energy density.
It does. It has about 40 milli electron volts to the fourth power. Ish, maybe 35.
EV to the fourth power,
mm-hmm.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
I thought it was left.
Your plot on the left is not the most optimistic because you're not choosing the largest kinetic mixing kappa that you can have, right? That you're fixing kappa to be 5, 10, 10. It could be larger for some masses.
Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely, yeah.
So you could have a larger signal.
Absolutely, yeah, I'm showing like the, kind of roughly like the end reach, but yeah, like if you can have a viable coupling at 10 to negative 4, in which case this signal would be much more easily detectable. Yeah, I'm almost done. Yeah, and this note, so this, so I was just at this workshop and I actually learned that there's already an experiment underway trying to look for relativistic dark photons. So that's also an exciting prospect. I was initially thinking of repurposing dark matter once, but people are also interested in directly looking for relativistic stuff. So their target that they told me they're trying to reach is roughly 10 to the negative 10. And then if that goes ahead, then that may be much easier than trying to do a funky modification to something that was designed to do something else. Okay, so let's conclude. My takeaway is, so we can have lots of dark radiation, more than you thought we could have. And the key number to keep in mind is about 2 to 3%. The temperature is about a factor of 5 larger than CMB. So that may not seem like a lot, but energy density scales like temperature to the fourth. So it ends up being quite a bit. Directly detecting the stuff is challenging, but if you're trying to go after relic backgrounds, this is an additional benchmark you can look for that is easier to reach than the relic benchmarks. And particular axions and neutrinos seem very challenging, but there is some hope for dark photons with a variety of experiments and approaches. And yeah, I'm excited about studying that in more detail and exactly kind of going the direction that Junwoo mentioned. All these experiments have different designs that are using different optimization principles, and there's more work to be done in understanding exactly how they are sensitive to a relativistic signal as well. Okay, and that's it. Thanks so much.
So if I'm heating up the C nu B, would that not change the effects of neutrinos on small scale structure?
So those are dominated by the massive neutrinos?
Yeah.
And the relativistic one does not meaningfully contribute to that. So
it's sensitive to the sum of the neutrino masses, but there's an assumption in there, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's an assumption about their number density, yeah, which you're changing here by heating up the C nu B.
Okay, so what we did look at, so in the case where we looked at just stuff being dark, that number density, you mean just through the gravitational impact of the neutrinos? Or, yeah, so in that case, I think it's interchangeably if you call it a neutrino or another relativistic particle with the same number energy density. And from putting it into class and looking at how things like the matter power spectrum change, we found that these changes are small and are degenerate with marginalizing over lambda CDM parameters. So there's no big smoking gun there, which was unfortunate, actually. It would have been like, cool, yeah.
Other questions?
Okay. I want to go back to the NSR piece. Because I think like the dominant signal is a non-Gaussian entity, right?
The non-Gaussian in this late universe model, the non-Gaussianities are
like the perturbation you are generating is non-Gaussian in nature, right?
You mean okay, this late in the universe?
Yes, but like I think if you generate like a late universe non-Gaussian perturbation, it will like imprint like maybe through or something. Like at least like a structure you're going to see.
But what data is telling us is that you're in a regime where the perturbations don't matter, where they're extremely small.
No, but I thought the non-Gaussianity is growing both at like a small gamma over H and also large gamma over H, right? That's what I remember.
But this is in the context of warm inflation, right?
Yeah, like you are but in the late universe, like your CC, like which start with like a no perturbation, start to generate like through this interaction new perturbations which are non-Gaussian, right? So that should at some level like affect the galaxy that we see and generate non-Gaussian things.
You mean why is it not good?
Huh? Because like I remember like a three like well scalar field like diagram is enhanced both in the large and small like a more rich regime, right? Or whatever like you call that.
What I'm thinking is that the data puts us in a regime where the perturbations are small, so the 2-point function is small.
I think only the 2-point function is small, like when you take like the ratio to be small, the friction over Hubble to be small. I remember the B grows like even at a small like friction over Hubble.
So what you're saying is you think there can be a small 2-point function but a huge 3-point function?
Yeah, exactly. No, like the 2-point function is small like, for some like a very like a specific reason.
Yeah, I have, to be honest, I have not thought about the 3-point function at all in this context.
So what scales would this be large on, the 3-point function?
I think it's some characteristic K scale. These perturbations grow like just really fast. I remember like some higher, really high power law in time. Right?
But where do you want to, okay, so where would they would show up? I mean, at very late times, where would you measure those? Where would you even measure them? Like not in the CMB, right? Like in the CMB, you're at this low multiples, so you wouldn't. So you're thinking in.
I don't know, like if it will be low multiples, but like if like in the late universe, my CC becomes like a very non-Gaussian, like what would it look like? It sounds to me like it would look.
But I think this is exactly what I'm saying. In the model that in the regime of the model that is viable. Dark energy is smooth, so your perturbations are small, and if your perturbations are small, then
the 2-point function.
Yeah, I don't see how that can be possible.
Yeah. So if the 2-point function is setting the RMS size of the fluctuations, and she's saying those are tiny, so who cares if it's non-Gaussian? It's a tiny amplitude fluctuation.
We can look at these papers. I think it's large. Like the 2-point function is canceled. No, the fluctuation I think is very large. It's only like the 2-point function is canceled because of some, like it's only like affected by the UV contributions. But the 3-point function is more like affected by this instability.
By which, you mean by the perturbations growing?
Yeah, by the effect that the perturbations growing.
And in which data do you think that would show up?
Well, like a new problem. That probably know more like if the CC becomes very non-Gaussian at the time. It sounds to me like all kinds of things would be able
to. The expansion rate, you know, fluctuates spatially. They'll regenerate, like matter perturbation.
Yeah.
But I'm still just, puzzled about, like if you're saying that, you're saying that 555 can be much larger than phi squared to the 3/2,
I think so. For some particular k like a ratio, or something. So I just remember it's a correct, at least like in the like inflationary case, I remember exactly like they were saying like the 3-point function is way more important.
Maybe let's talk about it more. I'm still not sure how, because if you're completely perturbative, then any correction should be small. And your observable should be delta phi over phi. So if delta phi over phi is small, even if you look at the 3-point function of that, it should still be a small net effect. But you can't dominate the universe with that in a way that would drastically shift the cosmology. That's my intuition. But let's look at what you have in mind in more detail.
Questions on Zoom? Okay, doesn't seem like so. I guess we can thank the speaker.